Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired and educated on all things writing, editing and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my Patreon page over at patreon.com. For supporting the production costs of the podcast each month, you'll receive additional conversations with each week's guest, you'll receive a personal thank you from me, and of course, a shout out on the show. It's an exclusive community of writers who, for only $3 a month, want to support the show and ensure it continues. If you'd like access to additional material and a shout out on the show, go to patreon.com/EmmaDesi. So come on over to patreon.com/EmmaDesi, where I'll be waiting to welcome you into the family. Okay, let's dive in to today's episode. Stephanie Han teaches online at drstephaniehan.com, delivering women's creative writing workshops that focus on empowerment through narrative. She authored the fiction collection Swimming in Hong Kong. She's the recipient of the Paterson Fiction Prize, a finalist for AWP's Grace Paley Prize for Short Fiction and the Spokane Prize. And she's also been shortlisted for an Asian Books Blog Award. A Penn and Vona Fellow, she received grants from the LA Department of Cultural Affairs and is the inaugural English Literature PhD graduate of City University of Hong Kong. She lives in Hawaii, the home of her family, since 1904. And Stephanie was actually my writing teacher when we both lived in Hong Kong, and so it's a real treat for me to have her on the show and find out about all the amazing things that she's been doing since we were there. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm thrilled to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you, Emma.
So I wonder if for our listeners, if you could tell us a little bit about how you became a writer, your journey to authorship.
Sure. I was always a kid who liked to read, and I think that's the key. I read because I could enter different worlds and spaces. When I was little, we moved around every year and we often lived in places. I'm Korean American, Asian American, where I was kind of isolated socially. And so I remember asking my mom in the 70s, "Mom, I don't have any friends. You know, what can I do?" And instead of the modern mom, which would impart social emotional learning skills, my mother said, "Read a book, because if you read a book, you can always have friends." And then she dropped me at the library, pretty much like that. And so that started my writing journey, because I became a reader, and people who read a lot eventually try their hand at writing, which is a natural relationship, because you want to be in dialogue with the characters or the writers or your imagination, and make those things that exist in your mind often real on the page. So that is really what started my writing journey, which was being a kid who didn't really fit in and who wanted to figure out maybe where she belonged in the world. And I wasn't a good I wasn't like a really precocious reader or anything when I was really small. I was very slow to read. Actually, in kindergarten, I would have been held back and flunked now. I didn't even know my alphabet, I think, until I was almost 6 years old. But I quickly became a reader. So by the time I was about 9 or 10, I guess several years of social isolation, I became a pretty avid reader. And then I continued reading. But even through high school, I had I always loved literature classes and I liked, you know, discussion, but I was never a kid that necessarily excelled at writing the analytical essay. I just liked to read. And that's what I think put me on my journey to reading and write, you know, being a writer, honestly.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing to think that that was your kind of start, because then when we come to the end of your education, you in fact were one of the first students to be issued with the first female student to be issued with a PhD from City University. Oh no, is it the first student? Full stop.
Yeah, I was the inaugural student for the PhD program in literature at City University of Hong Kong. I'm really grateful for the opportunity. I have to say it wasn't as if I was ever ambitious to be a PhD. I was in my late 40s and I thought I was going to get a job teaching at that university. I had an MFA and I didn't have a published book at the time. So I thought I was going to get the job. The chair thought I was going to get the job. The sub-department chair said, no way is she going to get the job. I didn't know about this. I felt upset. The chair was kind of freaked out and, you know, he knew my writing cause I was a journalist and, he said, you know, Steph, these are hard economic times. This was after the financial crisis and, you know, let's face it, you're unemployed right now. This is a hard time to be a writer. Would you like to be the inaugural PhD student? And I was like, I'll think about it. I was still mad. then I thought about it and I was like, okay, there's a small stipend, whatever. I'm going to get paid to read and write for a year. We'll see. After a year, I wasn't really sure I wanted to do it, but by then I was in too deep. I had already done a year and they had brought a scholar in so I could work with the scholar and they financed me. And so, yeah, that is how I became a PhD. And I'm very glad that, I did it. I am very, very glad, but it wasn't as if I was, you know, my whole life dying to become one. And actually at that point in my life, I had changed a lot. I had already read a lot of the canon that I should read. And probably if you had asked me, do you want to be a PhD in, you know, art history or archaeology or literature, I would have picked archaeology. I would have wanted to do something totally different, you know, because I don't know, just to explore something new. It's in literature in English. It's in Asian American literature in specific. And I focused on aesthetics. And looking at Asian American literary aesthetics in particular in the 21st century and where the literature is heading and how it's not necessarily a literature only of politics. But
well, that's interesting given what we'll talk about in a little bit about where you are now.
Sure.
And well, congratulations on your PhD. You've made history by being the first one. So well done.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned before that you have lived in many places. So I know as a child with your family, you moved around a bit and then you went to boarding school. And I know also as an adult, you've moved and lived in lots of different places. And in fact, we met in Hong Kong, but now I'm in Scotland and you're in Hawaii. You've got the good deal there. But how have those experiences, if they have, or maybe, but how have those experiences of living in different places had an influence on your writing?
I think what it's allowed me to do is to see different kinds of perspectives. You know, moving allowed me, in a sense, to go out into the world, to look at the different ways the people live, to try to reconfigure what you're forced to, you know, anybody who moves from one town to another, country to country, you know, has to reexamine. Well, not, some people don't. So I take that back. But if you are sort of sensitive, you sort of reexamine what beliefs you had. And then you have to restructure these to some degree because you're seeing a whole bunch of people live in this way. And so what does that mean? And so, and it also, so this is, I think, the most significant part of moving around, and what it taught me was to look at different people, look at different situations, and try to see myself in terms of this idea of difference and movement and how I fit in the world.
Yeah, interesting.
And when we were both in Hong Kong, you were my writing teacher. I had a fantastic season of writing with you. And one of the ways that you helped me was you introduced me to deep reading, which I confess I don't do enough of. But I wonder if you could explain for some of our listeners what deep reading is and how it can benefit us as writers.
Sure. So deep reading and close reading, this is foundationally a very important skill, but also it can be a little bit miserable. It's sort of the sweating part of writing. It's like the sit-ups of writing or something like that, the bench pressing of writing. And basically it's moving very close into the sentence and trying to break down the sentence and looking at the different words. What does each word mean? You know, if you read a line of a line in a poem or a few sentences in a paragraph, what is contained in these two sentences that echo and reverberate throughout the book? What word, how does this word match with this word, this syllable? How does this syllable sound with this syllable? So what you're doing is you're taking a microscope and you're moving very close. And what that allows you to do is really think about sentence structure, how words carry different nuance and connotative meaning. And so it's a practice that I think is very important if you want to write, and it helps with critical thinking. So deep reading, close reading, this is foundational to a lot of ways that we teach critical thinking, particularly in secondary school and in undergraduate years. And as a writer, it's important because then you become very conscious of, you know, the words that you're putting down. Ideally, you don't stop yourself up so much that you won't write anything because you can't overthink it. But when you're editing and looking at it, you can see, does this sound beautiful? Is this mellifluous, the way these syllables go? Does that sentence kind of echo to the sentence at the end of the chapter? You know, you can think about things like that. And that's important, right? It's a work of art. Literature is art.
And so is that a skill that one would use in the first draft? Or is it generally we would go back and use that kind of those tools in the revision?
Yeah, you know what? When you're doing the first draft, you're kind of vomiting on the page. I mean, you're just sort of putting it all out there, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to let your creative juices go. And then, you know, we can sometimes play with it, let's say even on your first draft. But I would say going over it, you can think about that a little more deeply. Because deep reading and close reading, that's really tied also to editing, right? How we have to look very carefully at things. So it's just a skill to use and to deploy. And sometimes, you know, when we read often, we don't do that. But you ever notice when your eye catches a phrase or word, you reread it? That's why there's something in there. It's weighted and you enjoy that one sentence and you're like, yeah, that's so right. That's so true. And that's an example of, you know, deep reading, close reading.
Okay, cool. Yes, my dad used to do that. He was a slow reader anyway, but it would take him even longer because he's the kind of reader who did love to go back and reread a paragraph or reread a page. I don't know how he had the patience to do it so often, but that was him, was great enjoyment. Now,
that's awesome.
As a writing teacher, you certainly were working with me and I was very much a new writer. What are some of the common mistakes that you see new writers make? And do you have any suggestions as to how they can avoid making those kind of foundational mistakes?
One of the main things is structure. That you need to have a beginning, a middle, and end. I don't want to get into all the details of it because there's lots of debates surrounding story structure, right? Experimental writing, or is it valid? Blah, 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 blah. But you do need a beginning, middle, and end, okay? Because it's, you know, what we're trying to do when we write is we're trying to bring an idea of unity, right? We want people to feel good when they read or after they read. We want them to, you know, your words are filling up what they're thinking, but they don't have words for. And so this idea that brings unity is often an idea of a beginning, middle, and end. So you need to have that. I would say that's one of the main things. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, we're people and we identify with characters. I mean, I guess, you know, you can have an animal as being a character, but we tend to, and I'm speaking of prose, not so much poetry, which is different, which is fragments and, you know, emotions and fleeting feelings often. But we need a character, and you need to think about this character, because this character is what people will project onto. So you need an interesting character, and the character does not have to be perfect. The character needs to be interesting and three-dimensional, and we don't have to make the character do everything right, because no one is right. People go to reading because they have problems, and nothing is more boring than reading about a perfect character, right? That's not the human experience. We find solace and we find companionship and we find relief when we meet a character on the page who seems to be going through some of the things that we go through, or understanding this or that, or is sensitive in the way that we're sensitive. And so making a character that's realistic, or well, if you're writing fantasy, you can make one that's phantasmagorical or whatever, but a character is key. So that's, character is the action, is the story.
Do you think that a character needs to be likable? Interesting,
no.
Likable, kind of different things?
No. There is a difference, though. Americans tend to like protagonists that are sort of more likable. I noticed that in British literature, there's a little more room. There's not the expectation that the character always has to be likable. The character can also be complicated and not likable. And that's also interesting to read, right? We all would love to read the villain, or we all love to read somebody who drives us crazy. But Americans, and I think this has to do with the kind of American cultural ethos, tend to lean towards characters that are, you know, it's cultural characteristic that are likable, or, you know, pioneering, defy the odds, all that kind of stuff. I mean, look at Hollywood. Hollywood's American.
That's true.
You know, so it varies from culture to culture, what the expectations are. And it has to do with the cultural norms of what they think people should be. Right.
Right. Okay. Yes. I'm just going to move us on a little bit and to talk a little bit about what you do. As first of all, as an instructor, and then also your own writing as well. But you're on your website, you mentioned that you talk about warrior women writers, and I love this phrase. I'd love to consider myself a warrior woman writer. So where did this phrase come from, and what for you is a warrior woman writer?
Oh, okay. So I when I was young, I read the book The Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston, Chinese American writer. And this is one of the first books, it's a creative nonfiction book that was written by an Asian American woman. And when I read this, I really liked, especially the opening pages, the opening first chapter, where there's this, you know, woman like who seems to be defying, and she's a warrior woman, conventional norms. Previous to that, I had read a book which was also nice, but the little Asian girl was doing everything her parents wanted, and it was really annoying to read. So The Woman Warrior offered a kind of a creative, imaginative relief, right? And so I had this previously on my website, but I started to think about women who kind of step out the conventional role, in that they take a stance. They are unafraid to let their voices be heard in some way. And what does that mean? And how does it, you know, what does it look like? And I thought it's important for women to see these kinds of women, these different kinds of women who've taken the risk to let their voices be heard. And, you know, when I started it before on my other website, it was, you didn't have to be a writer. There was a costume designer, or, you know, people who take a stance also in their community, right? Community activists who maybe sort of defy a social norm about how women should be. And so I recently revived that, you know, woman warrior writer, because I thought a lot about how it's very brave for women to simply write their story on the page, to write a story down, to declare that you have the right to write as a woman is really a bold act of defiance and rebellion, because everything that we are as women is down to the interpreted texts that have set our way of living through religion, finance, culture, everything. You know, we are governed by laws and social mores that we did not write. We interpreted them through the years, but we have not written them. And women haven't been writing for very long at all, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they always point to like Sappho, but the reason you're pointing, because it's so rare, she's the only one you can think of, you know, or Murasaki, you know, from Japan, Tale of Genji. But so I wanted to showcase women who can show other women that they can learn to step out into the world and raise their voices and, yes, author their lives. Mm-hmm. In other words, write their own story of who they are, metaphorically and literally. Mm-hmm. We always are authoring our lives. We exist in this narrative of life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're our greatest story.
That sounds like that's kind of prompted or led you in the direction of what you teach online now and the classes that you hold, looking at intersectionality and in particular the experience of Asian and Asian American women. So are these kind of some of the concepts then that led you towards focusing on these areas?
So I was asked actually to teach a class on Asian and Asian American women's literature by some students, because a lot of young Asian Americans and do not have the opportunity to study Asian American literature in college. Either the classes are not offered or their parents told them they should be an engineer. And so they told them, don't take that kind of class. And so this is part of the gap that I was attempting to fill, and also to provide a forum, because there may be particular cultural notions that have bound Asian women within the context of nation and what they're writing about. And so this has been a great class. I've really enjoyed it. And intersectionality, this manuscript workshop, is really it's open to all women. And you know, women who are working on a specific book project, because it's a long haul to get through a book. And women need the kind of support to do this. And so that, you know, that has, you know, everybody's represented in that group. It's really just open. And it's a good learning experience, because intersectionality deals with this idea. It was the concept of intersectionality was put forward by a Black legal scholar who stated, Crenshaw, who stated that, you know, you can't just be your race, you're also your gender, you're also, we have multiple identities, right? And our feminism and our ideas of self and writing are not determined by simply one thing. They're a confluence of many things. And so this is what the class also attempts to do, is to show women the different sides of the many different ways we are women, and to honor and to learn and to respect the different journeys we've traveled, and to help each other bring those words to the page and to encourage us to go further out into the world with our individual and our own community's idea. And how do we intersect? How do we help each other? How, as women, do we work? Mm-hmm. You know, so.
They're fantastic. Yeah, I imagine that they are in great demand. I can imagine from a lot of women that you know. Yeah. Now, one of the things, again, that I saw on your website was, and I quote, the practice of writing is not always connected with the realities of publishing. And this is something that I think a lot of writers, there's a big gap there. And so you mentioned that some of your published works were later rejected by other publishers. Some of those rejected works then later won prizes. So it's really showing a great disparity there, or how just subjective fiction can be.
Well, you know what? It's not, I'm like a professional reject. Like, I've been rejected hundreds of times, so many times I could actually probably write a dissertation on it, because I've watched the evolution of rejections from when you used to have to send in an envelope and there was a debate, like, should you send in an old envelope or a new envelope? And then you'd wait for the little tag. Should you only do it one at a time with mail? That would be once every 3 months. You know, like this, I've been rejected for decades. Every story I wrote in my published collection, Swimming in Hong Kong, was rejected, with the exception of maybe one, well over 100 times. And the whole collection was also rejected multiple times. And in fact, this book, after it was published and won awards, I got 3 years after the publication date, this is only just 2 years ago, I got a note from a pretty well-respected editor telling me that they like the book, but yeah, blah, blah, rejecting it again. And I emailed, I said, sorry, you're too late. It's already been, it's already been published. It already won awards. It's out. You know, you're free to reject it, but maybe you better rethink some of your criteria. Yeah. That's what I did say.
That's amazing. So, very, I think, yeah, reassuring for a lot of
because what happens now is, yeah, what happens is we associate publication with validation. You are valid simply because you wrote something. You are writing, and this in itself is a different act of you getting published, okay? And a lot of what publication is down to is being seen by somebody for who you're inside, your creative expression is. And you know what? You examine that deep and hard, because maybe in the end, I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but maybe in the end, all you want to do is be seen by one person. And, you know, that's a really long journey then to attempt to travel, to publish, to this and that, when all you want is, you know, your cousin to say, you know what, you're a good writer. I see you. I see you. And, you know, so that I think is what people really need to examine, who they want to be seen by and where that comes from. And I think that will sort of solve a lot of the publication angst, mm-hmm. Because it's about validity. But you should always separate that, because there's a lot of subjectivities that go along with it. If I believe only 5% of the books are published by, you know, people. Yeah, so that's all I want to say, is that you can always always write, because that's what makes you a writer. Publishing does not make you a writer. Writing makes you a writer.
Yes, so well said. So well said. So I'm conscious of time, and so I didn't want to finish without asking, what are you writing at the moment? You mentioned you're swimming in Hong Kong there. Are you continuing with your poetry? Are you writing short story?
Well, right now, what I've been focusing on is writing a book to help women to write their divorce story. So I am very interested in, I was a writing teacher for many years, in giving women sort of semi-prescriptive, you know, manuals or books to help them find their voice. This is really my priority now. And so I'm writing one to help women write their divorce narrative. And this can be used potentially when they submit it, if they can, to court during the divorce. And it's also, and or can be used for healing. So I invite these women who are undergoing a divorce to please, you know, join the Facebook group, Rewrite Your Divorce Story, and sign up. I give a class on writing your divorce narrative. I'm finishing writing a little bit of an introduction to a book of poetry and some prose that I wrote while I was in Hong Kong, because what I realized was I used this kind of writing to try to understand where I was. And I think that a lot of people get afraid of poetry, of writing it, of looking at it. And poetry, again, you write for yourself, can be used for yourself. And so I want to, I have my book done, but I want to give instructions about how you can use it. And my book is just like a test case for how you can try to write your own book. And then finally, I'm finishing a project. It's a third project, and they're all linked, called tied to a class called Power Journal, which is to help women write their own book of philosophy. So it's 30 prompts. It's based on ideas, let's say, of the I Ching, which are philosophical concepts and used to govern your life. And you can respond to these prompts. And at the end of the 30, you'll have your own little personal book of philosophy. So when you're not sure where to turn, you open your own little book. And what did you think about this concept of balance or love or parents? And you have your own little book of wisdom. And sure, you can ask opinions of people, but you know the answer inside, and you can look at your own book and rely on yourself. So these are all, I'm sort of finishing up all of them. They're almost all done. So they should be ready, boom, boom, boom. And they're really instructional guides to help women. Right.
Gosh, and you are busy. You've been very busy. Yeah. And will you be kind of looking for a publisher to do that, or will they be available?
I think initially for the divorce writing manual, I might release that myself as an independent kind of book, because it's a practical guide. Mm-hmm. If I should turn it into something longer, more of a fiction or nonfiction piece, that would be different. But I think this guide, which might only end up being, let's say, 15 to 20,000 words, is a useful little workbook type of book. And I'm all about using my skills now to help women write their stories. That's really what I'm dedicating my life to at this point.
Yeah, it's lovely. So where can listeners find out more about the work that you're doing online?
Sure. So right now you should go to drstephaniehan.com, drstephaniehan.com, and sign up for a newsletter. I'm, kind of rehabbing and rehauling my website, but there'll be classes up soon. And also drop a line and let me know, what do you want to learn about? I'm happy to, that's how the Asian American Women's Workshop started, because I had a few Asian American women say, I want to learn literature written by Asian American women. Can you help us? And I was so thrilled, because that was an area where I could help them, right? And it ended up helping other women who joined the class. So if there's something you feel you need help with writing, please let me know, because chances are, if you need help, there's another woman who needs help, and we can have a class.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, Dr. Stephanie Han, thank you so, so much for your time. It's been lovely seeing you.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you so much, and good luck.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you found that helpful and inspirational. Now, don't forget to come on over to Facebook and join my group, Turning Readers into Writers. It is especially for you if you are a beginner writer who is looking to write their first novel. If you join the group, you will also find a free cheat sheet there called 3 Secret Hacks to Write with Consistency. So go to emmadesi.com/turningreadersintowriters, hit join. Can't wait to see you in there. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.